creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Last week on Culture Click, we brought you polar explorer Will Steger's talk on his eyewitness account to climate change during his expeditions. Today we continue the dialogue with Fresh Energy's J. Drake Hamilton. Hamilton is the science policy director at Minnesota's Fresh Energy. Her responsibilities include scientific analysis, policy development, and advocacy of clean energy solutions to global warming that will maximize economic opportunities for the Midwest. Hamilton serves on the board of directors of the U.S. Climate Action Network and joined Fresh Energy in 1995. Hamilton's discussion will center on Minnesota's own clean energy initiatives and present data that illustrates that action worldwide needs to happen to sustain life on our planet. She will also relate on how climate change can affect an individual's health. We take you now to part two of the presentation that took place on Tuesday, November 13th, in front of a packed audience at Winona State University.
I want to start with brand new news today out of the Yale University Project on Climate Communications, polling Americans on what they think we should do or not. Here's what they found. A large majority of Americans, 88% of Americans, say the U.S. should make an effort to reduce global warming. So never let anyone tell you the public isn't there. 88%. Nearly all Americans, 92%, say the president and the new Congress should make developing sources of clean energy a high priority. Let's make that happen. All right. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit, but as you saw from my reading the poll results, the reason we're here tonight and the reason we're traveling around doing a series of forums all around Minnesota is that the American public believes that we should take action, and they know that the policymakers are the ones who should take the first actions. Already, actually, they're too late. Many Americans have started reducing our own carbon footprints, but we know that that is not enough. So we need leadership at the business and political levels going forward. Couple of words about my nonprofit organization. We're based in St. Paul. We are 21 years old. We were formed by a group of Minnesota citizens who were deeply concerned that Minnesota was completely dependent on imported sources of energy in 1991 when we were formed, and was exporting billions of dollars every year to bring in dirty energy into the state of Minnesota. We thought that this was a bad deal. We thought that Minnesota could do better, and that we could make energy efficiency and clean energy improvements that would bring local jobs in Minnesota and lead the way to a clean energy economy. And that's what we've been busy doing for the last 21 years. We work throughout the state of Minnesota, and we work at the national level. Here's why it matters what's happening with the sea ice, those videos that Will Steger showed you. We are Minnesotans. Some of us are Wisconsiners, sorry. Not used to being in a border community. We are Midwesterners, and we know better than some people on some of the coasts that climate affects most everything we see and do. It affects the weather, of course. It affects what trees are local to an area. It affects what wildlife live there and how healthy they are. It affects human health. It affects what diseases might strike us or not because we're too cold or too warm. And as we've seen in spades this summer and fall across North America, it affects extreme weather, floods, droughts, severe weather that the scientists call extreme weather, and I call it expensive weather, because that's what it is. It's very expensive. It's expensive to ecosystems, and it's expensive to our pocketbooks. So take a look at this list. This list, by the way, was constructed by President Obama's science advisor, Dr. John Holdren, who has taken a leave of absence from Harvard University to advise the president on science. And he constructed this list of why climate matters. You all know this. But many people don't know that, of course, then climate change, especially very rapid climate change and very unpredictable climate change, will put all of these things at increased risk. So if nothing else, if you don't care about the health of fisheries and the impact of ocean acidification, probably you're not alive. Because the availability of food and water and the quality of life for all of us are very closely intertwined. And so Of course it matters what happens with the climate, and of course it matters how fast that happens. I have one chart for you that, for me, is instrumental in telling the story of why scientists are calling our attention to this issue. If we look back over the last 650,000 years of record and look at the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it has varied. Now, if you're only looking at that period of time, you would say, well, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has varied. And at times, the Earth was in an advanced state of an ice age, where there's less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, or the interglacial, we're in an interglacial period now because there's not ice above us. Carbon dioxide has varied over time, but it's varied over a very narrow band, a very predictable band. Now, what has happened since the Industrial Revolution, that's what's happened to carbon dioxide. Will Steger was showing you the last 60 years of that. That's nearly a vertical rise. That is an unprecedented amount of rise when there are 7 billion people on Earth. So that is why we need every thoughtful person in this room and on this globe thinking about how to deal with this issue. Because humankind developed and developed agriculture in cities in a much more stable climate, and we're moving into a different set of circumstances. And in order to keep humans healthy and human societies healthy, we're going to need to address this problem. We know that it's a problem because we can test nearly everywhere you are on Earth. You can find observations and data, not computer models, but actual data about what has happened in recent history as climate variables have changed. Here's just a look at very heavy precipitation. So 1-inch, 2-inch, 3-inch downpours, and how much more common they have become. Look at the upper Midwest where we are. So just in the lifetime of you or your parents, we've seen a 31% increase. And look at New England. My goodness. They're seeing it in spades. But everywhere we're seeing these changes going forward. So we can actually observe the changes. We don't have to take anyone's word for it. We can go back and look at the data. And Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin have excellent state climatology offices that have documented these data. You can download them from the web and see it for yourself. Here in southern Minnesota, this is a set of graphs that was created by the Minnesota State Climatologist. And he created it shortly after September of 2010, the last storm on this list. And you know why he created it? He exists in a world of data. And when he was gathering the data from the September 22 and 23 storm that hit southern Minnesota, parts of which rained down 17 inches in a day, he thought to himself, wait a minute, this has happened before quite recently. So he dug through the data and found the other two storms within a few year period that were 1 in 1,000 year storms. Or they should have occurred. Statistically, they should have reoccurred only another 1,000 years hence. Not 3 years later, and not 6 years later. And so it used to be when we talked, sometimes we talk in the Twin Cities about adapting to climate change. And we have a lot of people who work in hydrology, and people who work in transportation systems, great engineers of all types in the Twin Cities. You know, it used to be that you would sit down and talk about adaptation, and someone in the room, they're good researchers, they would say, we should have someone do a model of what would happen if 17 inches of rain fell in downtown Minneapolis during rush hour. And you know what? And some people would say, well, you know, that's you're looking 30 years out or you're looking 50 years out. It happened in southern Minnesota in 2004 and 2007 and 2010. So it's not a remote possibility. We just got lucky. I know that people were damaged and people died from these storms, but we got a little bit lucky that it didn't happen in downtown Minneapolis during rush hour, to be honest with you. But we won't always be that lucky. So we need to think about what would happen anywhere in Minnesota if these things happened. We also have increasingly evidence, and we have started working with the American Lung Association at Fresh Energy, because they have documentation of especially the very old and the very young among us who suffer from respiratory and cardiovascular problems and asthma And they know what will happen with increasing pollution from global warming and increasing numbers of heat waves. Exacerbation of asthma attacks, more premature deaths, more emergency room visits, more lost school and work days. They know that this will happen, and they have started to speak out in Congress. The American Lung Association has. So that should give us all strength going forward. And in Minnesota, I do not suffer from allergies, but I know a lot of people who do. And in our little office in Fresh Energy in the last year, we started noting just anecdotally that people seem to be sneezing and wheezing a lot more in 2011, 2012, and for a longer period of time. And when we looked at the records, again, look at the observations, the allergy season in Minnesota ended in 2011 on December 8th and started again in early March 2012. So that is barely a 4-month respite for allergy sufferers. And the pollen allergens are projected to get worse with global warming. So we know that there are health impacts here. All in all, we know that the Midwest region will fundamentally change. And then what turns out to be the only uncertainty is what we're going to do about it. How will we react to this new information that's coming at us every day? Well, what I've observed is that people tend to ask questions like these about climate change. They want to know about what it will happen in their area. They want to know about likelihoods. And they want to know options for responding. And these are all great questions. One of the resources I refer people to is the U.S. Global Change Research Program. You can find it on the web here. Because it addresses, in pretty much lay terms, you can look by region of the country, so you can look at the upper Midwest and see what's projected to happen, or you can look at what interests you most, and whether that's agriculture or water or forests or cities or health, you can take a look and get a snapshot of what we're in for, and then you can go and delve deeper into their references. So this is a document, a set of research reports conducted by and peer-reviewed by scientists. I highly recommend them. We have a set of responsibilities in front of us. I've laid out the realities here. You read them for yourselves. And what spurs me on and what drove Will Steger and myself and our teams to come down here tonight is not a sense of hopelessness, but instead a set of choices that are in front of us that we can make and our business leaders and political leaders have to make that can slow down climate change, help us adapt to it, and get us off fossil fuels and build a clean energy economy. So that's what our charge is. Another place to look for information. Thanksgiving is coming up, just next week, right? And I know most people sit down to a Thanksgiving table, and people say this to me, there's Uncle Bob at the table. And Uncle Bob doesn't want to hear about global warming, and Uncle Bob doesn't think it's real, and Uncle Bob thinks wind turbines are ugly, or whatever it is their version of Uncle Bob thinks. And maybe the Thanksgiving table isn't the best place to do this, but for people who don't yet have an open mind about how to gather information, many of you do here because you're affiliated with the university. We need to make sure that people, when they're gathering information about climate change, are gathering it from experts. And probably your Uncle Bob, unless he works for NASA, is not an expert on climate change. But there are plenty of climate change experts, many of them hold positions, volunteer, appointed positions, exalted positions at the National Academy of Sciences. So that's one of the types of places you should look for peer-reviewed information. And you can find all kinds of statements, but they in particular have a climate change statement. And if you show something like this to people who are starting to get an open mind, are starting to see the extreme storms and starting to ask questions, refer them to documents like this one. And maybe a way to get them to start reading this document is to tell them that the National Academy of Sciences was created by President Abraham Lincoln in 1863. A good Republican struggling with the Civil War in 1863, but on top of that, he was dealing, imagine 1863, the advances in medical science, the advances in engineering, the advances in natural sciences, and he knew that he had a Congress who was not steeped in science. He knew that he needed a scientific advisory committee, so he created the National Academy of Sciences. And you can bet a president now, even this incoming Congress, needs scientific advisory panels, and the National Academy is one of those to rely on. Minnesota is on a clean energy path. Minnesota is one of the leading states in ways I'm going to tell you about because there's been extensive debate and discussion among policymakers in Minnesota, and bipartisan majorities of them have agreed that we need to move in a better direction. Here's a sense of it. First of all, in 2005 and 2006 and 2007, the Minnesota legislature took testimony from climate scientists, and they learned that there is a human fingerprint on climate change, that humans aren't causing all of climate change, that there's natural variability still in the system. They learned that there will still always be winter, but that things are changing so rapidly that the natural resources of Minnesota and the industries based on natural resources are at risk. What am I talking about? Tourism, agriculture, forestry, urban development, all at increased economic risk. And so taking that to heart, the Minnesota legislature passed in 2007 a law called the Next Generation Energy Act. I see a lot of members of the Next Generation out in front of me. Thank you for being here. When there were actually specific deliberations and committees in the legislature where young people came and testified in favor of the Next Generation Energy Act and these science-based goals that you see here. What Will Steger was saying, we need to effectively decarbonize the economy. And the first shot is we need to get at least an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the middle of this century. So that is the official goal of the state of Minnesota. How many people here knew that? One. Two. The woman who wrote it knows. So that's part of the reason we're here. People don't know that. It's a good thing to be proud of, and we need to work to achieve that goal going forward. When the young people came to testify to legislative committees, I saw one of them, a young woman, get up in front of the legislators. She'd probably never done it before. I think she was 16 or 17 at the time. And she looked at these goals, and she just did a little exercise in front of the committee. And this was a committee of pretty old folks, let me tell you. But she went through and she said how old she would be in 2015 and 2025 and 2050. And you could look around that committee and you could see the light bulb go on in those folks' head when she hit their age. And it made them think, this is real. Somebody who is in front of me now, who will someday be my age, will be dealing with these problems. It was a very effective technique going forward. I don't know how she thought of it, but it was brilliant. Now, when we're trying to get an 80% reduction in carbon pollution, we better have a really good handle on where it's coming from. So what I've done side by side here is where the carbon pollution comes from in Minnesota on the left and the US on the right. So you can see, in general, very strong similarity. One big difference: we're an agricultural state, so our agricultural wedge down there in the lavender is bigger than the national average. That makes sense. But one strong takeaway from this is if someone asks you on the street tomorrow, where does most of our carbon pollution come from? It comes from burning coal to produce electricity. If you ask most Americans, they're going to say SUVs. And that is because we have lots of experience with SUVs, right? I would walk out the door here and I would see a bunch of them parked in the parking lot, and I would see a lot of them on the streets on our way home to St. Paul. But we don't have that much direct experience with coal-fired power plants. And we had a policy for a long time in this country to keep electricity sources transparent and to focus instead on keeping the lights on at very low cost. And we did a really good job of those last two things. And the result is nobody knows where their power comes from today. So we need to fix that. So if you're going to go about getting a 30% reduction by 2025 and then an 80% reduction, I think the best thing to do is to figure out where you're going to get your biggest bang for the buck. And so clearly, moving away from coal to renewable and efficient sources of energy is the best thing you can do. In the transportation sector, which is still very important, and about 20% of that is on-road vehicles, you need to think about efficiency and better fuels and giving people really good choices so that they don't have to drive most places. And that's a tall order, that last part. So just to give you a sense of where this is coming from. Also driving this discussion and making it maybe a little bit easier in Minnesota is that we're not a coal state. We don't have coal mines or oil wells in Minnesota. We get those things from other states. And so for Minnesotans who are concerned about a competitive edge, a lot of us are saying, let's build more clean energy in Minnesota and keep those dollars at home. That's why Fresh Energy was formed. And the other reason is, let's keep more energy dollars in Minnesota's pockets. So in other words, not using energy and stopping the waste of energy going forward. The other thing driving this very recently has been that the price of coal delivered to Minnesota has doubled in the last 10 years. Three reasons for that. One of them, this is just one of the coal mines that provides power for coal for Minnesota. And you can, by the way, go on the Bureau of Land Management's website and you can find out which coal mines and which parts of coal mines in Wyoming and Montana provide coal to the companies in Minnesota. So you can trace back your coal. I'm trying to get some student interested in doing a video of where our coal comes from, because I think that would be fun to trace that path. So it gets dug up, increasingly deep, challenging geography. So just digging it up has become more expensive. Secondly, we put the coal generally on trains. The trains are monopoly owned. And so they come into Minnesota and the rail freight costs have increased greatly. The third thing is something that I never imagined when I was taking economic geography in college. I was a geography major. And in economic geography, you were told some things are too bulky to export. It doesn't make economic sense to export large quantities of bulky, heavy materials like coal. And now we are exporting coal to Europe and we're exporting coal to Asia. That means we're in a global market and the price of coal has increased. So that has started to get Minnesota utilities and their regulators to start thinking twice or three times about burning more coal. That's a good thing. The second thing that Minnesota did, and these laws were all passed in 2007, a landmark year, was two other very important things closely tied to those carbon reduction goals. First, Minnesota has energy saving goal for every natural gas and electric utility in the state of at least 1.5% per year. And we have a renewable energy standard that says that every company that sells electricity in this state by the year 2025 will get at least 25% of its electricity from new sources of renewables. As opposed to when this law was passed, it was about 75% coal. So moving away from coal and cleaning up that system. Minnesota is now one of 29 states that has such a standard. How are we doing? What is the progress we're making? Every utility in the state is on track to meet the energy savings goals. In fact, the biggest utility company in the state, Xcel Energy, produces about half the power in the state. They have actually documented that through energy conservation, they have prevented the need to build 9 medium-sized power plants. Now think about what that means. That means there were 9 power plants we never had to pay for. There were 9 fights over power plants and where they would be built that we never had to undergo over years. And there were 9 sets of environmental and health implications that we never had to go through. We never had to decide, do we want more nuclear power in the state? Do we want more coal power in the state? Do we want more hydroelectric dams on our river? We dispensed with all of that by taking the cleaner, cheaper source, which was energy savings. And then the beauty of it, the utility companies actually have to report, which is great. It's great to have a regulated monopoly. Utility companies are a regulated monopoly, and it's very important that they're regulated. So they can be made to report how much they have and audited for how much they have spent on energy conservation and how much they have saved all of us. And they have saved at least $5 for every $1 they've invested. Think about that. Think about any investment you could possibly make and whether your short-term gains would be that high. And I can't think of anything that would be that favorable. On the renewable electricity standard, all utilities are on track or exceeding this. We have enough power installed. We're getting near the point where we're powering as many as 1 million average Minnesota homes going forward. So we're meeting that standard too. Here's what it looks like graphically. So back in 1990, when folks like Fresh Energy and others started talking about a renewable energy standard, we had barely 1% wind and hydro and a minuscule amount of solar at that point. And that's the blue section at the top. And now we're at a stage where we're getting at least 13% of our electricity just from the wind and other renewables on top of that. So when you look at this piece of pie that's the really dark green, the kind of olive green, that's coal. And you can see that as they've ramped up renewable capacity, the utilities have ramped down coal. They literally run the coal plants less, and they're starting to close coal plants. So this is a benefit for the environment and for climate pollution. So we can see the progress. It's real. Policy makes a difference. Since I'm a geographer, we decided to put that on a map. Because when I heard that we were number 4 in the country in wind power, I liked that. I like to be near the top. But I also asked, who are number 1, 2, and 3? And it turns out they are our neighbors. And so this map shows you that there's something about the upper Midwest where the people in those communities are realizing that we have a capacity that has been underdeveloped, and we can grow jobs and clean energy right here in our states, and in some cases, export it to other states. It's an export product. I mention that because I'm looking at North Dakota and South Dakota. Most of the wind power in North Dakota comes right to Minnesota, where it's purchased by Minnesotans. And that's a great thing. We love to get more wind power from Minnesota, maybe a little less coal power from Minnesota, from North Dakota, excuse me. All right. So we see that there's progress. We see it starting to become a very significant part of our electricity system. We can also track money flows. And one of the money flows that's important is how much are landowners who are leasing land for wind turbines getting paid. You see that a very substantial amount. And the property tax payments that those wind turbines are paying into the community. And we know that there are communities in southern and western Minnesota that are paying for schools and roads and libraries with some of those property tax payments. And the current number of wind energy, indirect and direct jobs in Minnesota is about 2,000. So this is a real and vibrant and could be a rapidly growing part of our economy. But our work is not done. We also need to take a look at how federal standards for our health can help improve this situation. So in the United States, there is something called the Clean Air Act that's been around about 40 years now. And you get a sense from, this is a former Republican senator, U.S. Senator Dave Durenberger, who some of you will remember, who is still very much alive, and in April 2011 wrote this to one of the local newspapers, just documenting the benefits of the Clean Air Act, setting health-based standards to reduce pollution from power plants and cars. Very significant. And the reason he wrote into the paper was because the Clean Air Act was and still is under attack in Congress. People who would weaken the Clean Air Act and say that it doesn't have any benefits and that it's not worth the money that we're spending on it. But clearly, the track record of 40 years shows that things are different than that. I think I'll skip that now. In Minnesota, we have demonstrated the viability of protecting human health and how that can be done at very low cost. So, for example, up until December of last year, about a year ago, there was no limit on the amount of mercury that could come out of a coal-fired power plant. And if you don't know, the mercury is in the coal. When you burn the coal, it gets released into the air and goes into our lakes and water and our fish and sometimes into our kids. And it's a neurotoxin. It's a dangerous brain toxin that damages developing children's ability to think, read, learn, walk. Very important skills, obviously. In 2006 and the few years leading up to it, Fresh Energy, working with two of the biggest utility companies in the state and the Pollution Control Agency and a few legislators and some people from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, got together, and we were gathered together under the premise that this was unacceptable. That is unacceptable in a state like Minnesota, where you have a constitutional right to hunt and fish, that we teach our kids to fish and then tell them, but honey, don't eat more than one meal of that fish a week because there's a fish consumption advisory at that lake. That's unacceptable, that we needed to do something about it. And what we needed to do about it was not to keep our kids from eating fish, but to fix the problem. So we went to the number one source, burning coal. We worked with the electric utilities, and we got them to agree that for the 6 largest coal units in the state, they would voluntarily reduce mercury emissions 90%. And Ahead of schedule, 5 of 6 of those units have reduced mercury emissions 90%. And your bills have not gone up as a result because they found a really efficient, cost-effective set of solutions. And they showed that it was possible to reduce mercury. And that leadership back in 2006 in Minnesota was actually discussed on the floor of the US Senate last year when our own Senator Amy Klobuchar got up and said, when I hear from utility companies in other states that this can't be done or this will shut down electric power, I refer them to utilities in Minnesota who have made it happen at low cost and say, why can't you do it? And now it is the law of the land. There's a mercury limit of at least 90% reduction from every coal-fired power plant in the country. That is according to the Clean Air Act. That's why it's important. And we need to move and also regulate soot from power plants and carbon from power plants under the Clean Air Act. If we did that all together, this is the estimate from the Environmental Protection Agency of what we could prevent, not in 40 years, but every single year going forward. So we're talking again about cardiovascular health, respiratory health, asthma, really work and productivity of human beings, human health. It seems like a really important investment to me. What do we see in the future of energy policy for Minnesota? For oil and transportation, the second biggest source of carbon pollution, we need to do 3 types of things, and I'm going to go through these in reverse order. Maybe the hardest thing to do is to figure out how we get transportation options that are not motor vehicles for more people that are actually attractive to people. So it's not like trying to convince your grandma to bike, if she doesn't bike already, but it's trying to figure out what real people need to get where they need to go for work or for healthcare or for school that will actually work in that environment. And so we need a lot of different skills to apply that to that kind of behavior change, but really attractive options. Secondly, we need to make sure that the fuels we're putting in cars are much cleaner over time. So for example, a next generation of biofuels that uses much less water and doesn't compete with sources of food. How can we use our great land in Minnesota to produce really sustainable biofuels? There's a lot of research going on in Minnesota. I'm very hopeful about that. And the third thing, which is number one on the list, I put there because it's being achieved. Last year, President Obama, working with the 3 domestic auto manufacturers, reached an agreement to increase fuel economy for cars and light trucks so that by right now it's on average about 29 miles per gallon. By the year 2025, it will be on average 54.5 miles per gallon, so roughly doubling. And here's what you should think if you're interested in carbon pollution. If you double the efficiency, you cut carbon in half. And so that's what's going to happen over the course of the next few years in this country. It's the best thing the US has yet done to fight carbon pollution. And it's also going to save all of us money at the pump. So we'll be getting better cars, we'll be using less foreign and other oil, and we'll be fighting carbon pollution at the same time. We should do the same thing in other sectors as well. What about solar? Sometimes people say, well, Jay, you talk a lot about wind when you're talking about renewables. And the reason we started with wind in Minnesota is pure economics. That in most of the geography of Minnesota, the cheapest renewable energy to develop is wind energy. And you always, a principle for addressing global warming that applies to your household or your dorm room or the whole country is start with the cheapest source first. And so the first thing you should do before you invest in wind or solar is make sure you're not wasting energy in your home. So maximize energy efficiency, then do the cheapest source of renewables, and then see how you can make the other sources cheaper. That's our next task with solar power. Here's the good news. In all the Midwest, Minnesota has the best solar resource. Think about winter days, which we're about to have a bunch of. The coldest winter days, I bet you, when the temperatures are the lowest, beautiful cobalt blue sky. Plenty of solar energy getting in there. And solar chemistry works better at lower temperatures. So one way that we're better with because of colder temperatures in Minnesota is that the photovoltaics are more efficient, slightly more efficient. We already have some jobs in Minnesota from solar that are really below the radar screen because they are the components of things that go into solar panels and solar arrays in many towns in Minnesota. And yet, a lot of people in Minnesota are starting to investigate this question of solar, are starting to look at our solar resource and see that it's better than parts of Florida or parts of Texas, and saying, why aren't we doing better? And getting really stymied when we look at the states that are leading on solar policy, where there's the most investment, where it's cheapest to get solar panels, are states like Oregon, rainy Oregon, or New Jersey. I grew up in New York, and let me tell you, rainy New Jersey and cloudy New Jersey. Worse solar resources than we do, but policymakers who have prioritized it and figured out how to make it work. We need to do the same thing in Minnesota. So here's what we're asking for you to do today. If you came in, Mark, who's in the back, probably handed you a set of three postcards. Because clearly what's needed, in addition to individual interest and passion, is for our policymakers to make climate change and clean energy a priority. So these are three different postcards to Governor Dayton, to your state representative, and to your state senator. They say identical things on the back, and here's what they say. We want you to be a leader in these things. And so, especially as we've elected new representatives, we need to hold our elected officials accountable. And we need to know what they are doing, and we need to be their helpmate and friend, and make sure that your elected official knows your name and knows how you can help and provide information and backing for them to make progress on clean energy. We urge you to do this. What Will Steger and I are going to be doing is delivering thousands of these cards from all over Minnesota directly to the governor and to the state legislators. And that delivery makes a big difference going forward. We also urge you, if you like this partnership you've seen tonight with Will Steger and Fresh Energy, to help support us. You can become a member of one or preferably both organizations. We could really use your support. It will help the Will Steger Foundation advance climate literacy and engaging you, young people like many of you here in the climate movement, and will help Fresh Energy advocate for clean energy and climate protection at the state legislature and to give more outreach presentations around the state going forward. We're on an 8-city tour. Winona is number 3. We've just been to New Ulm, and we've just been to Brainerd. And looking ahead, we've got Rochester, St. Cloud, Bethel University in St. Paul, Concordia University in Moorhead, Willmar. So we'll be in a lot of different parts of the state doing the same thing, and we'll be having big crowds like this in all of those places. So know that you are not alone, but we need to make our voices heard more aggressively going forward in a very constructive way by a new generation of people of all ages who see that in 2013, when we have all of this information in front of us, and we know that there are so many economic risks of inaction and risks that other places will get it before we do and seize the clean energy economy before we do, we need to ask our elected officials if they did what we think is needed, and that is, in 2013, when we know everything we do about carbon pollution and clean energy, did we do everything we could, and did it work? Thank you very much.
A big thank you goes out to the Winona State University Department of Geoscience, the Will Steger Foundation, and Fresh Energy for the Clean Energy and Health Forum that was presented at Winona State University on Tuesday, November 13th in Stark Hall. Tune in next week for audience Q&A with Will Steger and J. Drake Hamilton, and for our interview with the two conducted by KQAL's Ryan Mangone. More information on Will Steger, J. Drake Hamilton, and Fresh Energy can be found at fresh-energy.org. You've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.